books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host Robert Kirkwood, and today an ancient secret society hidden in plain sight for centuries whose members protect the earth and its creatures. In E.K. Wise's book, The Keepers of the Rock, Book 1, The Dabili Rising. Plus, we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB library.
All that and more on today's Read On.
The Dabili Rising is book one of the Keepers of the Rock series by E.K. Wise. When you know the earth is dying, what will you do to save it? Tessa Horton always suspected there was more to life than what meets the eye. Her unique ability is proof. Tu Chen carries the weight of his secret power, hiding it from his family to protect them. Their lives change forever when they are accepted into the College of Geological Evolution, an exclusive international school with a hidden purpose. Author E.K. Wise is based in LA, California, but the Keepers of the Rock audio version was recorded in the UK and is narrated by Marion Hussey.
Allegria Heinein was the first keeper to greet Donald, and she smiled warmly as she reached his post. He bowed slightly and said,
"Keeper Allegria, it's good to have you back."
"Guardian Donald, it is always a great pleasure." She leaned forward and kissed both cheeks, hands on either side of his face. Her voluminous, curly brown hair tickled his neck. She spoke rapidly in a deep and scratchy voice, the speed of her speech characteristic of her Chilean culture. She stepped back and grabbed both of his lower arms, examining him. "You look well and nourished, Guardian Donald. This is always good to see." Her words were spoken in a complex Spanish accent, with a strong emphasis on the consonants. "What is this?" To Donald's horror, Allegria looked at the stain on his shirt, took a deep swipe with a bejeweled finger, and placed the finger into her mouth. She closed her eyes and tasted the nuanced flavors of the sample.
Yes, this is your wife's green tomatillo sauce, just as I suspected. Thank you for the recipe again. I tried it, you know, but it did not taste as delicious as this. I think it was missing some of the passion.
For centuries, the Keepers of the Rock, the world's oldest secret society, have protected the planet from both ancient evil and careless humans. They are gifted with abilities drawn from the Earth's own elements, minerals, rocks, and geological phenomena. And the keepers walk unseen amongst us, quietly guiding humanity towards balance. But a resurging evil has begun to rise. The Dabili, though diminished, now seek worldwide domination. As trouble brews, the keepers must train a new generation of heroes, students whose very abilities determine whether our planet is healed or dominated.
She eyed him mischievously with green eyes.
"Thank you, Keeper Allegria," Donald wheezed, clearly mortified. "I'll be sure to tell my wife that my colleague at the caverns enjoyed it."
"I see I have embarrassed you, Guardian Donald. This was not my intention."
She spoke fervently, with hands clasped to her chest.
"You must wear that sauce on your shirt proudly. It is a sign of your wife's deep love for you. To cook so passionately for the man she loves, to keep him satisfied. You ate it quickly and with relish, which demonstrates your avid appreciation."
Allegria kissed both his cheeks again and placed her hands over her heart, her eyes reflecting warmth. Finished with her elaborate greeting, she let Donald know she was ready.
"Okay, Guardian Donald, now we get down to business."
Allegria reached into her pocket and handed him two items. One was a carving of a small animal made from turquoise. It was a moose with shiny obsidian eyes. The other object was a piece of clear quartz, shaped into a distinct triangle. Both could easily fit into the palm of his hand. Donald took each item gingerly and turned to the table behind him. He lifted the lid of the ornately carved box and placed each inside, separated by a compartment. The triangle quartz fit into a felt impression inside the box made for the stone. There were 6 more exact impressions in the felt, and together they formed a circle. At the point of each felt indentation was an elaborate gilded initial. Allegria's quartz lay snug behind the A.
It's debili. It's actually a Latin word. And it's sort of like, I say it I write down that it's sort of like sheep. You can have one debili or multiple debili. One or more, they're still debili, but it's the word that the keepers, the heroes of the story, come up for the evil characters. They call them debili because they're weak and feeble. And then as time goes on, the debili, what they do is as they harm humanity, as they harm people for their own desires and own machinations, they wind up sort of like if you think of a chemical half-life, they basically start compromising parts of their soul. So physically and emotionally, they start to kind of fall apart. And so that's why the keepers call them debili.
Now, it's the first book in a series. Do you have an idea of how many books do you think there are going to be?
As of now, probably about 3. There may be a possibility of 4, just sort of depends. I'm actively beginning on book 2 now, so we'll sort of see where the characters take me. You know, you have a general frame of what's going to be happening and where the story is going. And then sometimes the characters, they decide they want to do something differently. And then you kind of follow down that tangent. And sometimes it takes you to really interesting places. So I'm excited to kind of find out.
And what was the spark? What gave you the inspiration for the novel?
Well, this is kind of funny. We lived in San Antonio, Texas for about 5 years. My husband's job took us over there. And we had our kids were younger at that time. And so my husband and I had this deal that we joke about, that if he paid the taxes, I would mow the lawn because he hated mowing the lawn. And I really didn't want to deal with the taxes portion of bill paying and so forth. So we had that sort of joking agreement with each other. And so I would pretty much on a weekly, biweekly basis, would have to go out the front and the back lawn and mow it all. And where we were living in Texas at that time, it's all on some limestone. And so when the houses are developed and they put dirt in, they put enough dirt in to be able to grow some grass and, you know, some little plants and stuff, but not a tremendous amount. So I would constantly get pinged with little limestone rocks. So I must have looked absolutely ridiculous because I would put on a ball cap. And then at that time, I didn't have any fancy sunglasses. So I would just grab whatever sunglasses were around the house that the kids had gotten from Halloween or someone's birthday. They might have been like a fluorescent color or, you know, kids' sunglasses. So I'm out there with my ball cap and while I'm getting pinged by these rocks. And during that time, my younger son had that proverbial rock collection and he was really excited about it. And, you know, the younger kids were interested in dinosaurs and that whole earth, being excited about the world in general and the earth and having so many questions. And as I would do this, I just started getting these ideas for these characters, especially the younger characters, the teenage characters who all had abilities tied towards the earth. So whether it's volcanoes or earthquakes or rocks and minerals themselves. And that's really where the story started. And then it just kept developing and actively became a whole world that I created sort of out of a love of my kids' interest in the natural world. And then also in college, I had taken a really interesting class that was jokingly called Rocks for Jocks. Was sort of like an intro to geology course. And I absolutely loved it. So that was sort of like the bookends of my interest between being an adult with an interest in geology and the environment. And then my kids' love of rocks and minerals and dinosaurs and all that stuff. And it all just pulled it together. And the story sort of was formed.
And it goes beyond that because you've not only used minerals and geological things around you. You go quite deep into the periodic table as well.
I do. Yes. Yes. So there's a love of science and I throw some history in the book as well, but it's an adventure story that really works on, like, talks about a group of heroes at a school. So we have the younger teenage, they're going into college. This is called the College of Geoevolution. And then the older teachers, their professors, who come together and help them. And their whole purpose in life that these students will learn that they have, that what their purpose is going to be, is to protect the Earth. So they are to protect the Earth. They've been there. The secret society has been around for thousands of years. And human beings do not know that they exist. They are very, very careful to make sure that regular people are not aware of who they are. And it's sort of like a, I wouldn't say it's a battle, but it is certainly an issue that these younger teens have to deal with, because they're, what they're learning to do is to protect the Earth with their abilities, but they are not there to protect humanity directly. So they kind of have to learn that human beings have to make their own decisions. They have to, you know, run their own governments and so forth. And these younger heroes are allowed to go and sort of protect the humanity from the evil characters called the Dabili, who also have the same abilities as they do, but they're not allowed to affect humanity. Humanity, they have to sort of watch that from a distance. And there's very good reasons for that. I go into detail into the book of why they cannot get involved and, you know, affect humanity's decision-making. That's not what they're supposed to be doing. And so we get in a little bit of history there and certainly some science, which is a lot of fun. So yes, I pull elements from the periodic table and mention those as well.
And even though this society has been around for thousands of years, the novel set in contemporary times is set in present day.
Yes, it is. It's an urban fantasy. So it's set in right around today as we're living our busy lives. Absolutely. There's sort of a love of the Earth and a love of the environment. And so it's sort of the heroes at the school, they're learning to sort of have a love for protecting the Earth. And I hope it inspires the readers, kid and adult alike, to, you know, do whatever we can, just our little bit, whether it's recycling or whatever it is that we can do to make this a better world and keep it going and keep it healthy. So sort of that's the honor that I put into it, that we love this wonderful Earth that we live on that's so magnificent and beautiful.
When this ritual was complete, Allegria smiled at Donald and caressed his shoulder as she went past. She stopped behind him to grab one of the metal folding chairs and took it with her, heading toward the center of the big room. Donald was a 57-year-old Caucasian man from New Mexico with a sterling record as a Federal Park Service employee and unremarkable in appearance. To all who knew him, he was a kind, responsible, and effective employee. Unbeknownst to almost all, including his wife, children, and the Park Service, he was also a guardian. Should the occasion arise, this kind, responsible man would fight tooth and nail and even die in defense of those he presently guarded. It was his sworn oath and most sacred responsibility, above all others. One day, when he died, the keepers would mourn him, but no uninitiated person would ever know of Donald's constant, silent vigils. Donald took a deep breath and cleared his throat, recovering from the whirlwind that was the charming keeper, Allegria. Whenever he saw her, she was in an ebullient mood, as if she were the cruise director for the other keepers. She seemed to improve the mood of everyone with whom she spoke. No sooner had he completed this thought when he saw a bright white kufi hat seemingly floating in air. Seconds later, the tall form of Dumisani Vead came into view. His skin was the color of rich earth with undertones of purple.
And we'll hear more about the Keepers of the Rock from author E.K. Wise after we take a visit to the RNIB Library.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems.
Michael Palin in Venezuela, written and narrated by Michael Palin, was given to us by Penguin Random House.
There's something about the name Venezuela. It has a ring to it. It drips enticingly off the tongue. It sounds exotic, tropical. ever so slightly unreal. An author would be pleased to have thought of it. A billionaire would nod approvingly as it was painted on the bow of his yacht. Indulgent parents would regret their daughter shortening it to Venny. It's a restaurant you wouldn't mind being seen coming out of, or a nightclub you wouldn't mind being seen going into. It could be the name of a saint, or a female pirate, a cocktail, or a luxury hammock. Such thoughts crossed my mind when I decided to make it my 100th country to visit. I'm glad to have been to Egypt and Moldova, to Iraq and Mali, but none has the same alluring cadence as Venezuela.
In February 2025, Michael Palin travelled to Venezuela to get a sense of what life is like in one of South America's most culturally rich, vibrant, but also troubled nations. In the journal he kept during the trip, he gives a vivid account of the towns and cities he visited, the landscapes he travelled through, and the people he met.
So, hallucinatory is the name, indeed, that even after my trip, I'm still not sure I've actually been there. It's home to the tallest waterfall and the highest cable car in the world, to desert and snow, to mighty anacondas and exotic blue crabs, and I know for a fact that I've seen them all. But somehow, because they're all wrapped up in the magic word Venezuela, they don't seem quite real. I'm also acutely aware that, seasoned traveller though I am, until we actually arrived in Venezuela, I had no idea of what to expect or what to prepare myself for. But that's what made those 3 weeks on the road so unusually exciting. There would have been a time, some 50 years ago, when everyone would have been talking about Venezuela. It was an oil boom success story, an investor's dream, a steadfast friend of its powerful neighbour across the Caribbean. It was the USA of South America. And then in 1998, an army officer called Hugo Chavez turned this relationship on its head. Chavez was a friend of the people, the Venezuelan people, not the American people. He was a bit of Guevara and a bit of Castro. He had a big smile and punched the air a lot. After he came to power, the image of Venezuela as a comfortable capitalist haven was replaced by that of a purposeful disruptor of the status quo, as Chavez nationalized key industries, revolutionized social and welfare programs, and sought new friends on the international stage. The oil money kept coming in, but now much of the profit it generated, rather than flowing to Wall Street, was directed by the president to the poorest in his own country, those who'd previously failed to benefit from the wealth it created. Venezuela might, in the process, have become an inspiration to many, but it also alienated its richer citizens and, crucially, its former ally to the north. By the time that Chavez died of cancer in 2013, at the age of 58, his socialist dream was already fading. Spiralling government spending had caused the national debt to increase sixfold. Inflation had reached record levels. Oil revenues had fallen. His successor, Nicolas Maduro, lacking Chavez's powerful charisma, turned increasingly to the police and the army to enforce his will. And they proceeded to help him win 3 terms of office, each more authoritarian than the last. At his latest inauguration, a month before we set out on our journey, in early February 2025, Maduro had become, to all intents and purposes, a dictator. I've always been attracted to countries whose problems seem to outweigh their potential. Along with the team led by my director and series producer, Neil Ferguson, I'd visited North Korea, Iraq, and Nigeria to see how they were coping. Venezuela may have sounded more laid back and more appealing than all of them, but what I found was that despite its beauty and bountiful resources, the country was not living up to its promise.
Michael Palin in Venezuela, is read by the author and runs for 2 hours and 46 minutes.
The Predicament by William Boyd was given to us by Penguin Random House.
Gabriel Dax looked out of his kitchen window over his back garden and saw the fox slink along the foot of the beech hedge. It was moving almost daintily, its dense brush holding a steady horizontal line. He noted the rich amber of its fur offset by the dark brown of the near leafless hedge. The fox paused for a moment, as if to allow Gabriel to register the perfect juxtaposition, and turned its sharp head to stare directly at him, with animal clarity, or so it seemed. Then it slipped through a gap and disappeared into the small oak wood that lay beyond the garden's border.
Gabriel Dax, travel writer and accidental spy, is back in the shadows. Unable to resist the lure of his MI6 handler, Faith Green, he's returned to a life of secrets and subterfuge. Dax is sent to Guatemala under the guise of covering a tinderbox presidential election where the ruthless decisions of the mafia provoke pitch-black warfare in collusion with the CIA. As political turmoil erupts, Gabriel's reluctant involvement deepens. His escape plan leads him to West Berlin, where he uncovers a chilling relaxation. There's a plot to assassinate magnetic young president John F. Kennedy. In a race against time, Gabriel must navigate deceit and danger, knowing that the stakes have never been higher. In The Predicament, the second novel starring accidental spy Gabriel Dax, William Boyd weaves a masterful tale of suspense, loyalty, love, and the dark temptations of spycraft.
Gabriel felt a sudden whelm of apprehension and shivered. Was that a good omen or an evil one, he wondered. He was still troubled by last night's unwelcome phone call that he had received from his contact at the Russian embassy, Natalia Arkadina. She had requested a meeting, today, at the familiar place, the Café Matisse on the King's Road in Chelsea. He could hardly say no, given that the money Natalia and the KGB supplied him with had, to a large degree, allowed him to purchase his new home, this solid old Victorian cottage on the outskirts of Claverley, in East Sussex. He knew Claverley, having visited the place twice during his long investigation into the cause of the fire at his childhood home that had killed his mother, a trauma that had haunted him for most of his life. It was a fair-sized village, also, with an architecturally handsome high street, and well served with shops and amenities. When he decided to leave London, East Sussex had seemed almost a natural choice, and Claverley, after some property sleuthing, duly delivered the ideal house. Rose Cottage was uninspiringly named after a large rambler that had once covered its facade, so he had been told, now long gone, replaced by a clematis over the front door. It was a two-story square-built ashlar house with a steeply pitched slate roof. It was unpretentious and unadorned, apart from a stone ledge under the front eave with arched openings for doves, now blocked. He rather liked its simplicity and functionality. He had hoped that moving out of London might have put a symbolic distance between him and his various handlers, and the complications they brought to his life. No such luck.
The Predicament by William Boyd is read by George Blagden and runs for 8 hours and 5 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
And now a return to my chat with author E.K. Wise about The Dabili Rising, Keepers of the Rock, Book 1, which is narrated by Marion Hussey.
Dumasani Vayad began his biannual stroll into the caverns amidst children's cries of, "Ew, it smells in here! This is gross!" He smiled and never tired of the youthful exclamations. The keepers preferred the natural entrance, partially for this very reason. The smell of bat guano is a double assault on the senses. The ammonium oxalate opens the sinuses and makes eyes water. The onslaught instantly clears the mind and reminds each keeper to focus on the meeting and gather their thoughts. The limestone cavern was a magnificent gift from the natural world, but most importantly, it was a secure place to meet. Before entering the cave entrance, Dumasani surreptitiously glanced into the thick curtain of shrubs surrounding the cave entrance. After verifying no tourists were around, he quietly addressed his small, equally subtle companion perched on a strategic branch from which to begin her vigil.
My dear Salima, I need you to remain outside the cave and keep watch. Remember, my friend, you must leave the cave swallows alone. They are just as entitled to be here as you.
A few minutes earlier, Dumasani had caressed Salima's neck and discreetly fed her a morsel of meat to pacify her until his return. His constant companion, Salima, was a female Moroccan peregrine falcon who weighed less than 2 pounds. She was instrumental in alerting the keeper to danger and was quick, smart, and loyal to her master. Despite this, Salima made it clear that her attachment was by choice and not decree. Her breast was soft and white, mottled with black marks that upon closer inspection revealed a subtle blue hue. She symbolized the marvel of natural perfection, a strong, vibrant and proud bird encased in a compact and lightweight body.
What do you think took you longer? Was it the writing of the research?
Oh my goodness. I want to say all said and done, it was about 15 years for this first book. And that's of course, because I was raising my kids and taking care of elderly parents. I'm a clinical social worker by training. So that role kind of fell to me. So in between that, I put it all together, but I would say a lot of it went into the research. I really spent a lot of time digging into aspects of the science and aspects of the abilities. Even the names of every single character have meaning. So I took a lot of time. And that's actually a real aspect of this novel, is that it's international. So I have characters from all over the world. There is, when you talk about the older, the professors, the adults, there's one from every continent. And most of the students come from different countries. So I really wanted to make it more of an international flavor to it. And I think a big part of that was that I was very, very fortunate that my father's job when I was 11 years old took us over to London, actually, for 3 years. I absolutely loved it. And we would travel around Europe any opportunity that we had. And it just, you know, opened my eyes. And I loved being around other cultures and different people. So I really, it was important to me to sort of make this book one that sort of opened it up to the world. Since it is the whole earth, I wanted to bring in people from different countries and different cultures.
Now, we'll talk about the international nature of the book and the nationality of the narrator in a moment. But first of all, you're talking about characters' names having meaning. Tell us about Augie.
Yes. So actually, that's, thank you for bringing that up. Augie is really important. And Augie was actually developed by my oldest son, who's a software engineer. So he is a little owl. And what Augie says in the beginning is he stands for something. He stands for the advancement of unbiased global intellectual exploration. So it says below, see the adorable owl above. He's your little knowledge guide, Augie. If you read an interesting scientific or historic fact, the Augie at the bottom of the page will lead you to the footnotes, guiding you to further information. We at the College of Geoevolution challenge you to be curious and expand your awareness of the glorious world around you. Keeper Reese believes Augie's acronym is a bit pretentious, but I think it's clever and has a poetic ring to it. He won't admit it, but I know he wishes he thought of it himself. Go on, we dare you. There's always room to learn more. And that was written by Keeper Allegria, who's another one of the professors. So in the book, when I do mention either a rock or a mineral, or maybe a little historic fact, there will be a little Augie at the bottom that takes you to footnotes. And some of them are actually clickable. And I partnered with this wonderful organization called MindDat.org. And it's this organization of rock fanaticists, people who love studying rocks and minerals. So if you click on that link, it will take you to that rock or mineral in the earth, like a picture of it in the earth, and a whole bunch of scientific descriptions of it. And I just thought it was really interesting, as opposed to just reading about a diamond or an emerald or, you know, whatever rock or mineral might be. if somebody wanted to take a look at it, they could sort of see or get a description of it if somebody described it to them, what it looked like, to sort of help give them a better understanding of what was discussed in the novel.
Now, there are many characters in the book. We don't have time to go through each one, but let's look at the one. Why did you make one neurodivergent?
Yes, that I'm so glad you asked me that, Robert. I have three of my four children have ADHD inattentive type, and I actually have that as well. And I didn't find out until I was an adult. It was actually a very interesting. I was sitting on the couch in the therapist's office while my last child was getting evaluated. And for anyone who is going through one of these kinds of evaluations for a learning difference, oftentimes you'll go there 2 or 3 days because it takes several hours for all of these comprehensive testing batteries that you go through. And so I'm sitting there when my last child is in this process. And all of a sudden I had this epiphany remembering, oh my gosh, I remember my mom getting upset with me because I wasn't paying attention. And she said she wasn't going to help me with something anymore. And I realized, oh my gosh, I think I have the same thing, and then got evaluated myself. And indeed I do. And so I'm a huge advocate for learning differences and for getting evaluated. And so as I was writing the story, I didn't initially set out to have a character that was neurodivergent, but very clearly I could see that one of the characters was, when I sort of took a look back and I realized, oh my gosh, Tessa's going through the same kind of things that I did. So then I chose to lean into it. And I wanted to lean into it where she was learning that she had a learning difference and what that process was and sort of how she was feeling before she was diagnosed with that, and then how she was coping after she understood and was learning about how her mind worked better. And I think it's so, so important, because even just watching my own kids bloom when we figured out that they had a learning difference, and knowing that there absolutely are ways that you can work with it, and things that you can do, different therapies or medications, whatever, a whole group of different kind of possible treatments to help you become the best version of yourself. And so I really wanted to make that character in the novel. So, and that for me, it's Tessa. And what I love, I don't want to give it away, but there's a point in the story where she really becomes the heroine. And it's actually because of her learning difference. Her hyper-focusing ability comes into play, and it really makes her shine in the story. It's a pivotal point in the book where she's the one that kind of helps. I'm trying to get around this without just telling you what it is, but she's the one that basically helps everybody figure out what to do next, because she solves that dilemma that they have. And it was because of her ability to hyper-focus where others were searching, but not as effectively as she was.
This type of ADHD isn't hyperactivity outward. It's more hyperactivity internally.
Yes, it's very interesting. And one of the reasons why that's the one I wanted to highlight is because it's often the one that's missed. So kids who are hyperactive, it's a little easier to see that because they fidget a lot more. The teachers might see that they're just not able to focus and pay attention. The interactive kiddo can be sitting there absolutely still, staring at the teacher. And so they look like they're paying attention, but their mind is a million miles away. And my son, my eldest, who's the software engineer, used to say that he would be in English class and he was thinking of physics problems in his head. He was like turning shapes in 3D in his mind while he was supposed to be paying attention to English. So, you know, it looks like they're paying attention. And what bothers me about that is sometimes teachers will say, well, they're just not applying themselves, or maybe they're just not that bright, which breaks my heart, because clearly that's absolutely not true. So it's so important if you know of somebody or you have a kid who's just seems like they're just not paying attention, or one of the biggest signs is they're doing their homework and then forgetting to turn it in. The homework just sits in the backpack. That's a really good sign that maybe something's going on. And there's so many things we can do now to help that kid, as I say, be the best version of themselves. And it really the ability to affect their self-esteem and make them feel like they're really bright and smart and able to do whatever they want to do and be accomplished. It's so important. So I that's another reason why I chose what I have, the inattentive type, because I think sometimes it's missed by parents, by family, by teachers. And I know that, so I have to be careful when I say this, because when I was growing up, there wasn't as much, it wasn't as understood about learning differences. So I can't really be upset too much that it was missed for me. But there were so many places in my life where it was missed, where I just think people thought I just wasn't that smart because it just wasn't caught. But nowadays, we certainly have a lot more ability to do that.
Now, as an international novel, in fact, tell us, where are you at the moment?
Oh, I am in Southern California, Los Angeles area.
And I believe there's a TV show people can watch if they want to have an image of whereabouts you live.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, absolutely. So there's a show called MASH, which was set during the Korean War. And it's not on anymore, but it's I'm sure it's syndicated because it was an excellent show. And right at the beginning of it, when there are helicopters flying above, that is the area where I live. So it's sort of like this nice, there's these hills. They're beautiful. They're often not green because we don't get as much rain here as we need. But I haven't ever lived in a place like this before. I've never lived in an area where there have been hills, which is kind of interesting for me.
Now, as we said, it's an international novel. So was it important that the audiobook narrator was British?
Actually, it was not important she was British. But what was very important was that she was excellent at voicing foreign accents. That was very important because I've got characters. So I can give you an example here, looking at the adult professors. I have one, Naylin, who's Native American. I have Allegria, who's from Chile. I have Reese, who's Australian. I have Jürgen, who is from Scotland, and she does an amazing Scottish accent. Sahila is from India. And Dumasami, who is sort of like, he's the head keeper of all the keepers. He kind of keeps everybody in line. He's from Morocco. And the last one, Evren, is from Turkey. And then the children are all from different areas as well. And so it was so important to me that the narrator was able to voice those foreign accents really distinctly and uniquely. And she does a beautiful, beautiful job. And just so happens that she's British. And Marion Hussey is wonderful. I love her. And she's narrated several novels that I love to listen to as well. So I was so pleased when I was able to partner with her to read the book.
Dumasani held out two hands as he approached Guardian Donald.
Guardian Donald, it is with great pleasure that I lay my eyes upon you this day. I trust you and your wife are in good health, and that those you love are in good care.
He took Donald's hands in his as he spoke. His voice resonated a deep bass, and the pronunciation of each letter was emphasized and distinct. He gave slow reverence to each vowel and consonant. His accent, to Donald's ear, seemed otherworldly. He knew Keeper Dumasani hailed from Morocco in Africa, but Donald had never travelled so far away himself.
"Yes, Keeper Dumasani, I thank you for thinking of me, of us," he stammered. "It's good to see you as well. All is prepared as expected. Tourists are cleared from the natural entrance and the big room. Visitors remain upstairs, but will complete their tours shortly. The first keeper preceded you just a moment ago."
"Thank you, Guardian Donald. We can always count on you, I know. You will notice a distinct change in one of our keepers, Keeper Sahila. You've seen this from time to time, so do not be alarmed. But verify her identity in the traditional manner. Also, I believe Keeper Reese has brought a token for you and your wife. A thank you of sorts from us."
"Thank you, Keeper Dumasani. There is never a need for a reward. It is my pleasure and sworn duty to serve."
Another clip of Marian Hussey reading from Keepers of the Rock, The Dabili Rising, by my guest E.K. Wise. Now, I believe the way this one was published, you had to have it in print before the audio version could be made.
Yes, that's how it works. So I published it independently. I worked with Amazon, their publishing company. And then once that's published in written form, then you can then go and make an audiobook out of it. And so we wanted to do that as soon as we could, because I love audiobooks. My aunt is low vision, I guess you could say. And so audiobooks are going to be something that she will be definitely using in the future. Right now, she can still read large print, but that's sort of where she's headed. And I also just love audiobooks because I think, especially for a book like mine, where you have characters from different countries, I feel like it really opens up the story in a different way when you get to sort of hear the different characters and hear their different perspectives. It sort of just flavors it. I sort of feel in a way that just gives it like a grandness to it. And so I love listening to audiobook stories. And I often do that for myself because just, you know, I'm sure other people as well being very, very busy in their lives. Sometimes the best time for me to listen to an audiobook is when I'm walking my dog. And I'll just get little bits of time here to listen to a story.
You've kind of answered the next question though, but now it's in audio, it's accessible for people for whatever reason. Don't have a relationship with print, be that sight loss or dyslexia. Is that important to you?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's really important that books need to be accessible to everybody in whatever format they feel best reaches them. And as I said, my aunt eventually will be heading that way. And then also, I know some people just prefer audiobooks. Some people are auditory learners. Some people are visual learners. I think we've learned so much more about the different intelligences and how people learn and how people receive information. It just depends on what speaks to you, you know, and where you feel like you can concentrate best to internalize a story, whether that's reading it, whether that's hearing it, whether it's both at the same time. I understand some people really like to do that. And I think it's really important that we make books accessible to everybody.
I've heard that about ADHD before as well, that sometimes you won't have the attention span or concentration for a print book, but an audio book's quite different.
It absolutely can be. And I oftentimes find that actually. I love to read, you know, the act of reading an actual book. I don't get a whole lot of time to do it as much as I want to, but I do. But sometimes I will get to the bottom of the page and realize I didn't internalize any of it. And so then I have to go back because my mind will drift off and think of, you know, did I lay out whatever I needed to for dinner? Or did, you know, my youngest kiddo fill out that proper application or, you know, whatever. I'll just drift off. Whereas with an audiobook, I find it sometimes a little harder to do that. So yeah, I think it's so important that we make it accessible for everybody.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we're downloading the audiobook from the RNIB library is the cover. Can you give us a little audio description of the cover of Keepers of the Rock?
Absolutely. So there is sort of a teenage boy who is inside like a translucent gem. And this one is blue. It's like sort of a light blue translucent gem. And he's clearly doing something. He's using his hands. And obviously he has an ability and he's using this ability inside this gem. And then out there's this beautiful bright orange and red circle that encircles that person and the gem. And there are blue crystals sort of attached to that circle. And then if you sort of span out, this whole circle and gem motif is on top of some doors, which are the doors to the school. And those are sort of like iron. There's some iron hatch marks for the door and then the wood grain. And then off to the right, there is this bird that's flying away. And the bird, I didn't start off to make him a major character, but he's becoming a major character. And he is made out of rare earths. He's entirely made out of rare earths. One of the younger teenagers created him as he was traveling on a bus on the way to the school. And he's a little anxious, you know, because he's leaving home and traveling to this new school that he hasn't heard tremendous much about, but he's very excited about the possibility. And when he's either bored or he's a little anxious, he plays with the rare earths that he always has in his pockets because that's his ability. He's able to compress and shape rare earths, which are magnetic. So he works with magnetic rocks. And so he created this little bird, and just through their abilities, he sort of becomes alive. And his name is Edgar. This character gifts him to the headmistress of the school. So Zandra is the headmistress of the school, and it is her domain. And he gives her this bird, who she names Edgar. And Edgar sort of is allowed to roam around the campus at will. And he loves to do that. And he sort of loses pieces of himself as he wanders around. And then Two, who's the character who creates him, sort of has to collect those pieces and try to put them back on him. So he is becoming an important character, this bird.
Guardian Donald, we deeply value your loyalty and reward your service. It is our tradition and tenet to acknowledge your dedication.
Dumasani bent his head again and drew back. He reached into both pockets and handed over two objects similar to those of Allegria. His carved turquoise animal was a mountain lion with eyes made of red jasper. The triangular quartz was identical. Donald turned around and placed both items in their respective places in the box, the quartz fitting snugly into the D indentation. When he turned back, Dumasani had vanished and one less chair remained. Donald squinted into the passage leading into the big room. How had he not noticed his departure? Dumasani was a tall, imposing figure, yet somehow he removed himself with nary a sound. He was unwavering in his faith in humanity's innate goodness, despite having seen the worst it can deliver. He was the elder statesman of the Keepers and their leader.
The Dabili Rising, Book 1 of The Keepers of the Rock, is available commercially as an ebook, in paperback, and in audio. And E.K. Wise, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure to be on your show. I so appreciate it.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Oh my goodness. When we first, I mean, I had been a reader when I was younger, Beverly Cleary and stories like that, before we moved to England. But when we moved to England, a friend of ours that my parents knew came to the house and gave me a copy of Anne of Green Gables. And oh my gosh, I absolutely loved it. And I read the entire series and saw any kind of version of Anne of Green Gables that's available, I've seen. So that was probably my favorite childhood story. And funny aside to that is my younger cousin has beautiful red hair, and it comes from my father's side. And I really, really hope that one of my kids would have red hair because I love the story so much. And unfortunately it didn't happen. My kids have pretty colors, hair of brown and blonde, but no red. So that kind of made me sad, but that was my childhood favorite novel. And I loved reading it to my kids as well.
For reasons best known to herself, Marilla did not tell Anne that she was to stay at Green Gables until the next afternoon. During the forenoon, she kept the child busy with various tasks and watched over her with a keen eye while she did them. By noon, she had concluded that Anne was smart and obedient, willing to work and quick to learn. But her most serious shortcoming seemed to be a tendency to fall into daydreams in the middle of a task and forget all about it until such time as she was sharply recalled to earth by a reprimand or a catastrophe. When Anne had finished washing the dinner dishes, she suddenly confronted Marilla with the air and expression of one desperately determined to learn the worst. Her thin little body trembled from head to foot. Her face flushed and her eyes dilated until they were almost black. She clasped her hands tightly and said in an imploring voice, "Oh,
Please, Miss Cuthbert, won't you tell me if you are going to send me away or not? I've tried to be patient all morning, but I really feel that I cannot bear knowing any longer. It's a dreadful feeling. Please tell me.
You haven't scalded the dishcloth in clean hot water as I told you to do, said Marilla immovably. Just go and do it before you ask any more questions, Anne. Anne went and attended to the dishcloth. Then she returned to Marilla and fastened imploring eyes on the latter's face. Well, said Marilla, unable to find any excuse for deferring her explanation longer, I suppose I might as well tell you. Matthew and I have decided to keep you. That is, if you will try to be a good little girl and show yourself grateful. Why, child, whatever is the matter?
I'm crying, said
Anne in a tone of bewilderment.
I can't think why. I'm glad as glad can be. Oh, glad doesn't seem the right word at all. I was glad about the White Way and the cherry blossoms, but this... Oh, it's something more than glad. I'm so happy. I'll try to be so good. It will be uphill work, I expect, for Mrs. Thomas often told me I was desperately wicked. However, I'll do my very best. But can you tell me why I'm crying?
Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery is read by Sarah Menno and runs for 10 hours and 50 minutes. It's available from RNIB Library.
Is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Oh, yes. Always is going to be Pride and Prejudice. That is my favorite novel. I have such respect for Jane Austen and all of her novels, but particularly Pride and Prejudice. It holds a soft spot in my heart.
Within a short walk of Longbourn lived a family with whom the Bennets were particularly intimate. Sir William Lucas had been formerly in trade in Meryton, where he had made a tolerable fortune and risen to the honour of knighthood by an address to the king during his mayoralty. The distinction had perhaps been felt too strongly. It had given him a disgust to his business and to his residence in a small market town, and, quitting them both, he had removed, with his family, to a house about a mile from Meryton, denominated from that period Lucas Lodge, where he could think with pleasure of his own importance, and, unshackled by business, occupy himself solely in being civil to all the world. For though elated by his rank, it did not render him supercilious. On the contrary, he was all attention to everybody. By nature inoffensive, friendly, and obliging, his presentation at St. James's had made him courteous. Lady Lucas was a very good kind of woman, not too clever to be a valuable neighbour to Mrs. Bennet. They had several children. The eldest of them, a sensible, intelligent young woman, about 27, was Elizabeth's intimate friend. That the Miss Lucases and the Miss Bennets should meet to talk over a ball was absolutely necessary, and the morning after the assembly brought the former to Longbourn to hear and to communicate.
"You began the evening well, Charlotte," said Mrs. Bennet with civil self-command to Miss Lucas. "You were Mr. Bingley's first choice."
"Yes, but he seemed to like his second better."
"Oh, you mean Jane, I suppose, because he danced with her twice. To be sure, that did seem as if he admired her. Indeed, I rather believe he did. I heard something about it, but I hardly know what. Something about Mr. Robinson."
"Perhaps you mean what I overheard between him and Mr. Robinson. Did not I mention it to you? Mr. Robinson's asking him how he liked our Meryton assemblies, and whether he did not think there were a great many pretty women in the room, and which he thought the prettiest. And his answering immediately to the last question... Oh, the eldest Miss Bennet, beyond a doubt. There cannot be two opinions on that point."
"Upon my word! Well, that was very decided indeed. That does seem as if... But, however, it may all come to nothing, you know."
Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen is in the RNIB Library as read by Inelia Fox. It runs for 12 hours and 59 minutes.
And is there a book you've read recently you'd like to recommend?
I'm actually listening to A Tarnished Canvas by Anna Lee Huber. And she does the Lady Darby mysteries. And Heather Wilds narrates that. And I love her cadence. I just love the way she reads the characters and reads the story. It's just, she has a lovely, lovely voice. And this is a mystery, the Lady Darby mysteries. And they're actually set in Scotland. And they're wonderful. And so I'm listening to the latest one right now.
The bidding opened and swiftly climbed, with numbers being proclaimed from different parts of the room. 60 guineas, someone called out, and was acknowledged by the auctioneer. But before another word could be uttered, a terrible crash rent the air. Like those nearby, Gage and I glanced about us in confusion, trying to ascertain the source of the disturbance. Had some shelving fallen, or maybe some paintings had been overturned in the next room? Only when a harsh creaking noise began and the floor began to undulate alarmingly beneath our feet did I realize what was happening. By then, it was too late. My heart lodged in my throat as a thick cloud of dust rose up around us. Then the floor dropped out from beneath me and I plunged downward. Terror coursed through my veins and screams echoed in my ears, possibly my own. I was blinded by the debris which permeated the air, seeming to swallow me whole. It filled my nose and coated my tongue. Though the fall could not have lasted more than a few seconds, it seemed much longer. When I landed, it was hard, jarring every bone in my body. I didn't attempt to move at first, too riddled with pain and shock. I simply lay in the midst of the rubble of wood, plaster and bindings, sprinkled with broken furniture, artwork and bodies, struggling to breathe through the miasma of lime and dust. I didn't dare open my eyes, as I felt the fine particles of debris stinging my skin, almost like tiny insects.
A Tarnished Canvas by Anna Lee Huber is available commercially, as read by Heather Wilds.
And E.K. Wise, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. It was such a pleasure to be on your show. I so appreciate it. And I hope if people are interested that they enjoy Keepers of the Rock.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB Library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.